Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So we're reading in Book 2, Canto 4, and these lines which we just heard Mother speak mark where we stopped our study last time. It's on page 243 at the break. It means we've had a look at the first section of Canto 10, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Little Mind. And we have continued reading from that point to page 249, line 406. So this morning, we can go back to the break on page 241 and look at these lines which come next. Page 243, sorry, at the break. At the break, page 243, after the break, we'll start studying. Sri Aurobindo is explaining to us that mind is a power that has come into the earth evolution from above, and that its first effect of entering the consciousness of earth creatures was inspire the creation of myth. And he says that these early myths were a rich food for the consciousness of these developing human beings. He says much richer than the plebeian fare that we thrive on today. He calls it the tilth, the dry straw of reason. So through this action of myth, arousing the imagination, conspiring with true inspiration, this has enabled the golden child, the divine being developing in evolution, the golden child has begun to think and see. And now he will tell us about the different levels of mind that have come about as a result of this. So, Ramnaran, would you read on to page 243 after the break a couple of sentences, then we'll look at them more closely.
In those bright realms are my first powers, ignorant of all, but eager to know all. Its curious, slow inquiry begins. Ever its searching grasps at shapes around, ever it hopes to find out greater things. Ardent, golden gleamed with sunrise fire, alert it leaves upon its invention's work. Yet all it does is on an infant scale, as if the cosmos were a nursery game. Mind, like the playthings of a titan's day. As one it works who builds a mimic fort, miraculously stable for a while, made of the sands upon a bank of time, mid an occult eternity's soulless sea.
Thank you. We just started reading on page 243 after the break. Ramnarayana read the first lines after the break down to line 206. You've got it? This first emergence of life is like a sunrise. And he says the mind, that emerging mind, takes its first steps. It's ignorant of everything, but it's very eager to know all. So this slow process of inquiry about the world around it begins. And first, what it focuses on is all the shapes, the forms around it. But it's always wanting to expand its knowledge. In fact, this is continues to be a facet of mind that I don't know if you observe yourself thinking. It's somewhat like finding pieces to put in a jigsaw puzzle. You know? If we have the feeling that there's something missing, there's a space there that we don't know, we want to find that piece. And when we found it and fitted it in, immediately we become aware of other gaps in our knowledge. And the mind can't be satisfied until it has a larger picture. It's always wanting to expand its knowledge. And also he says that there's a lot of enthusiasm, ardent and golden gleamed those sunrise fires. Beginning of this sun, he said, there's a sun rising there, and out of its full orb, our mind will be born. Yet, in that early stage, everything it does is on an infant scale. It's a baby exploring the world, as if the whole universe, the whole cosmos, was a nursery game. Mind and life are like the playthings of a titan's babe, a baby of superhuman scale and capacity. But what it's doing is like a kind of play. It's like children are building a sandcastle, building a mimic fort.
Titan here is in a positive
I would say, neutral. It's referring to size and scope. It's not positive or negative. It works like a child building a mimic fort. We have such fun when we are children, no? Building sandcastles. That remains. It's miraculously stable for a while. Our early mind constructions. This mimic fort is made from the sands upon a bank of time, mid an occult eternity's shoreless sea. These lines remind me of the great physicist Newton, Isaac Newton, who has said that he of course made great discoveries and carried our knowledge about the universe very much wider and further. But he said, I feel as if I've just been like a little boy playing with pebbles on the shores of a limitless ocean. So it's the same idea, that whatever we can, and especially at this early stage, it's only a fraction, a fragment, a tiny portion of all that remains to be known. So there's a power which is working on the growing world and bringing it this mind power. And now he's going to tell us something more about that mind power. Betty, do you read, please, from line 207? Thank you.
Yeah, what means the great presence?
The great presence, I think, is the creative force of the divine acting here as nature.
One question. The word here, demon, D-A-M-O-N, and D-E-M-O-N, is not the same one.
No, they're not the same. Where have you got this demon? Okay, yes, daemon. Yes, yes, I think we can pronounce it like that. It's the original Greek word from which our word demon has come. But while a demon is an evil spirit, this daemon is an inspiring, positive spirit. Particularly, we think of this word in connection with the ancient Greek philosopher Socrates, who felt that he has this spirit within him who is giving him guidance. So I think that's what it means here, a powerful guiding spirit. In this case, it's the power which is nourishing mind.
And how did daemon become a demon? How did it change to demon?
Well, actually it's the same word, but we use this different spelling and slightly different pronunciation to distinguish between the later religious demon, you know, the evil spirit, from that earlier understanding of a spirit within who...
Can you speak a little bit about the nascent void?
Yes, he says, that what this great puissance had to do, her task is to teach the ignorance. And that's a difficult thing to do. And her starting point is the point where there's no knowledge, nescient void, an emptiness in which there's no knowledge. Can you find the page for Fanny? Page 243 at the bottom. So that's where the search for knowledge starts, no? And the illumination of the ignorance from this emptiness where there's no knowing, nescience. No? We have this whole set of words that have the word science at their center. Science means knowledge. So there's nescience, no knowledge. There's prescience, knowledge in advance. There's omniscience, all knowledge. So there's a whole constellation of words around this idea of knowing science. So nature is doing this work of teaching the ignorance, but she herself is nescient. What she teaches, she herself has to learn. And how does she do it? She arouses knowledge from its sleepy lair, as if knowledge is a hibernating animal, sleeping, curled up in its cave, no? And that's what the poet says. Knowledge doesn't come to us as a guest from outside. We don't invite it in. In fact, it's within us, a friend and inmate of our secret self. We're carrying all knowledge within us, but it has hidden behind our minds and fallen asleep there. And slowly it starts to wake up through the blows of life, the stimulus of experience. That mighty daemon of knowledge lies unshaped within us. And to evoke it, to call it out, and to give it a form is nature's task. That great puissance has the task to make knowledge available to us.
Is referring to intuitive knowledge also, like higher knowledge also?
Also, yes.
Not even the basic or nascent knowledge.
But it starts at the very bottom.
Yes.
It starts from this nascent void, and her job is to wake it up, and it wakes up through the experiences of life, and it gets different forms, so as to give it form. So actually, here he speaks about a small, keen instrument. This great power has chosen a small, keen instrument, and it will have three aspects, which we're going to read about in this canto. Lorraine, would you read? Line 220. All was a chaos.
All was a chaos of the true and false. Mind sought amid deepness. It took within itself, but saw not God, a material interim diplomacy, denied the truth that transient truths might live, and hid the deity in creed and guess, that the world ignorant might grow slowly wise. This was the involvement made by sovereign mind, looking from a green ridge into the night. In her first temperament, with inconscience, its alien dusk baffles her luminous eyes. Her rotted hands must learn a cautious zeal. Only a slow dance his earth can bear. Yet was her strength, unlike the unseen earth's, compelled to handle makeshift instruments invented by the life force and the flesh.
Thank you. So, in that first state, there's this confused mixture of what is true and what is not true, a chaos. And mind, that first early mind consciousness is looking around amid deep mists of nescience. It has very little knowledge hold onto. It's like fumbling around in a fog. Consciousness looks within itself, but it doesn't perceive God there. It doesn't perceive its divine soul. Sri Aurobindo says that the power which is directing all this uses an interim diplomacy. the idea that diplomats aim for certain things, but in order to achieve their aims, they may hide some knowledge that they have, just for the interim. They'll bring it out later, but for the time being, they will hide it. So that is what is happening. This power is denying the truth, the real truth with a capital T. It's doing that so that some truths which are temporary, transient truths, that they have a chance to exist. And so it hides the deity, the true truth, the divinity within. It covers it up with creed, belief, dogma, and guesses. And it does that on purpose, so that this ignorance of the world can grow wise slowly through evolution, gradually. He says this was the imbroglio, the complicated story or plot of a drama. That sovereign mind, the pure divine mind from above, is creating this complicated plot. It is looking from its gleam ridge high far above into the night of nescience and inconscience. When she has the night, sovereign mind has to look at this inconscient material world. It sees that it can't just flood it immediately with the full light of truth. There have to be many steps and stages for that. The alien dusk of the inconscience of matter baffles the luminous eyes of sovereign mind. Sovereign mind works so quickly, like magic. It's like waving a magic wand and things are done. But in this situation, working with matter, she has to learn a cautious zeal. Zeal is enthusiasm, going carefully. Only a slow advance the earth can bear. The material world, it can't absorb too much, no? And he compares the strength of the mind, of sovereign mind, with that of the earth, unseeing earth, inconscient, blind matter. He says that the mind's strength, unlike the unseeing earth's, was compelled to make use of makeshift instruments that have been already brought into existence in evolution. They've been invented by the life force and the flesh, living matter. This is what we've been reading about in the previous cantos, not how and in this evolution of life. It was only at the very end of Canto 4 that Sri Aurobindo began to show us the emergence of mind like a thin current of flow of mist amid the material earth. So above all this, supervising all this, is this power of sovereign mind. But she sees that she has to work with these makeshift instruments, what has been not the perfect tools she has on her in her own world, but what has been put together here in the evolving earth by the life force and living matter. And he develops that idea about the perceptions of earth. Rima, you could read, please.
Earth offers thee those doubtful images, hope you can see can prepare those jets of sight. Small lights kindled by the branches of a rooted thought, incapable of the soul's direct look, she is seized by spasms and vulgar knowledge sprout, maids true. The slave girl of her images, expelling nature's mystic unity, cuts into quantum and mass demonic form. She takes for measuring mold her ignorance in her own domain, a conduit and a seal. The greater power is her half-raven son, rose within limits but possessed. She knew by privilege of eating forth and then an infant solitude. In her eyes, however, darkly blinked but was lit. There a tender gaze who knows inspired his time and shapes the world in its path, in her own path, she stumbles, not halfway, but moves in boundaries of subtle power, across mind and step toward herself. A candidate for an higher
suzerainty.
A passage she comes from night to light and search for an underground community.
It's another word for sovereignty, for a ruling position. So our material ways of perceiving and knowing earth all perceives through doubtful images. All she conceives, when we perceive things and then our minds draw some conclusions from our sense perception. We develop a concept. So this material consciousness conceives through hazardous jets of sight. They may or not, they're just tiny little spurts of vision, and they may or may not be reliable. They are small lights kindled by touches of groping thought, thought groping around in the darkness. Earth, the earth power, is incapable of the soul's direct in-loop. So if she sees, she sees just a little bit at a time, spasms, this. And then she solders them together. Soldering is when we weld two pieces of metal together. You know. She collects all these little scraps of perception and solders them together. He says she makes truth the slave girl of her indigence. Indigence is poverty. Earth is deprived. And she forces truth to serve her poverty, her needs. So she does this by expelling nature's mystic unity, the oneness of everything. She cuts all these things into quanta and mass, all these little fragments, this knowledge scrap that she's gathered about this moving all, this moving universe. And how does she measure? How does she assess all that scrap? She takes for measuring rod her ignorance. Of course, we do this, our own standards we use to assess things. Our ignorance. That's the earth, the way that earth has to struggle to know the material principle. On the other hand, this sovereign mind in her own realm, he says, she's a pontiff and a seer. A religious ruler and a visionary, you know, with true knowledge. So that greater power than the mind of earth, with her half-risen son, she has to work within limits, the limits imposed by matter and the material brain. But she is in possession of her field. She knows, she has knowledge. She knew by a privilege of thinking force. She has a power of knowledge and of thought and claims an infant sovereignty of sight, the beginnings of true direct vision. The eyes of that mind power, he says, however darkly fringed, however dark her eyelashes may be, in her eyes is the light of an archangel. She can see with the vision of that archangel, that mighty divine power. Elsewhere he calls it an enchanter, a magician who knows, inspired what he's doing, and he shapes this world in with the power of his vision, its far-seeing flame. The mind power in her own realm, she never makes a mistake. She doesn't stumble or fall. She moves. There are boundaries, there are limits, but there are limits of subtle power, and mind can cross those limits and move further towards the sun of truth, maybe the sun of supermind. This mind power is a candidate for a higher kind of ruling position. And in this work that she's doing now in evolution, her task is to teach the ignorance. She cuts through from that night, that complete darkness of nescience. She cuts a way through for light. She's searching for an all knowledge that she hasn't yet, or that hasn't yet been grasped. In order to do that, she's going to make use of an instrument. A dwarf three-bodied trinity was her serf. And that's a very interesting, colorful picture of what comes next. Dwarf, small, three bodies, and he's serving that power of knowledge. Turiya, what do you read?
A dwarf, three-bodied trinity was her serf. First, smallest of the three, but strong of limb, the low brow with a square and heavy jaw, the pygmy throat, needing to live in bounds, forever stooped to hammer facts and form. Absorbed and cabined in external sight, it takes its stand on nature's solid base, the technician admirable, the thinker crude, the riveter of life to habits, rules, obedient to gross matter's tyranny, the prisoner of the molds in which it works. It binds itself by what itself creates. A slave of a fixed mass of absolute rules, it sees as law the habits of the world. It sees as truth the habits of the mind.
Thank you. I want to call up the picture of this dwarf. The first one. He's there, coming slowly. Here he comes, yeah. He's the smallest, but he's strong. You can see that. He's a low brow. He doesn't have much mental development. And his jaw here is square and heavy. This represents a pygmy thought. A pygmy is a small being. A pygmy thought, which needs to live within limits. And it's this fellow is forever stooping to hammer fact and form. He's taking the facts of life and the forms of life, and that's what he's working with. He's absorbed and cabined, very much concentrated and limited. He has a small workshop. He's limited by external sight. Only what he can see is real for him. It takes its stand on nature's solid base, material reality. What he can see with his own eyes, that's all that he believes in. And Sri Aurobindo says he's a technician admirable. He's very good as a workman, but not much good at thinking. A thinker crude. There's not much subtlety in his thought. And what he does is, riveting. We fix one piece together with a rivet. So what he does, he rivets life to grooves of habit, habitual action and thought. He's obedient to the tyranny, the absolute rule of gross matter. And in a way, he's a prisoner of the molds on which it works. This gross matter. This mind binds itself by its own creations. It's a slave of a fixed mass of absolute rules. This is fact, this is true, this is the way things are. It sees as law the habits of the world. It sees as truth the habits of the mind. Manoha.
It's real, complete images and plans.
Yes, you're in the right place. Yeah.
Turning in a warm circle of ideas and ever repeating old familiar acts, it lives content with the common and the moon. It loves the old ground that holds its dwelling place, adoring change as an audacious sin. Distrustful of each new discovery, only it advances step by careful step and fears as if a deadly abyss the unknown. Prudent treasurer of its forever always. Lord, sure memories are its capital stock. Only what sense can grasp seems absolute. External fact, it figures as soul cute. Wisdom identifies with the earth and things long known as actions are actions always done. Art lives clinging cold a balustrade of safety on the dreary stair of time.
Thank you. I think we can recognize this fellow.
Yeah,
when they were doing these paintings, mother told Hutto, she said, I have to fight with this fellow every day. And yet, it has a great value, which Sri Aurobindo is going to explain next. Tomoko, would you read?
Heaven's trust with Adi.
Yes, yes. That's where we are, Don. 297. Heaven's trust.
Heaven's trust with are the established ancient ways, immutable laws man has no right to change, a sacred legacy from the dear dead past, a grace from the great dead past, or the one road that God has made for life, a firm shape of nature never to be changed, part of the huge routine of the universe, a smile from the preserver of the world, sent down of all this guardian mind to earth, that all might stand in their fixed changeless height, and from their secure posture never move.
Thank you. Not only religion. The established ancient ways, the ways things have always been done, part of the huge routine of the universe. And the preserver of the worlds, that's Lord Vishnu. No? He's the one who keeps things in order the way they are to be. He's not the destroyer and he's not the creator. He's the preserver who keeps us all safe. No? A smile from the preserver of the worlds sent down of old, this guardian mind to earth, so that all might stand in their fixed, changeless type. For example, scientists have noticed that once a species is established, it tends to perpetuate itself in the same way. There may be slight mutations and changes, but basically a tiger remains the tigers remain the tigers. They may go extinct, of course. That each might stand in their fixed, changeless type and from their secular posture never move. This word secular has different meanings. Here it means it's connected with siècle, with the centuries, with the way it has been for centuries and centuries. Secular. Of course, it has another meaning. We distinguish secular and religious. But that's not the meaning here. Yes.
Yes. But he's talking about the mind here, correct?
Yes, but what keeps everything in place, it's the consciousness. So this tendency, which is quite strong even in our human consciousness, to stick to familiar things and changeless ways and all that. Fortunately, it's not the only thing, because we've got two other kinds of mind which are going to show themselves soon. But this is a very important one in keeping stability.
Keeping your feet on the ground.
Right.
When you don't have any city, keep your feet on the ground.
Yes.
Yes.
I remember Helmut and I were traveling when Indira Gandhi was assassinated. And we were warned, don't go, there's going to be so much upheaval in the country. And of course there was upheaval in the country. But after a week or 10 days or so, I realized that actually there's been a tremendous stability has been maintained. There wasn't a revolution. you know, things, I mean, dreadful things happened, but still there was this secular posture, Mother India keeping firm even in the most dreadful disasters. It's a very wonderful thing. It's not the only thing, but this stability, it's kept by the preserver of the worlds to give us a free, a firm base. So, what does it look like? Naren, what do you read?
One sees its suffering faithful to its task, tireless in an assigned tradition's surround, in decayed and crumbling offices of time. It keeps close guard in front of customs wall, for in an ancient night's dim advance, doses on a little courtyard stones and barbs at every unfamiliar light, as at a foe who would break up its home, a watchdog of the spirit's sense-raved host, against intruders from the invisible. Nourished on scraps of life and matter's bones, it is in its canal of objective certitude, and yet behind it stands a cosmic might. A measured greatness keeps its faster plan, a fathomless sameness rhythms of thread of life. The stars' changeless orbits furrow inert space. A million species follow one unique law. A huge inertness is the world's defense. Imminent change is treasured changelessness. Into inertia, revolution sinks. In a new dress, the old resumes its role. Their energy acts, a stable is its seal. On Shiva's breast is stayed the anonymous dance.
Thank you. Is it clear? Shall we move on to the next one? Next one. Who's going to read? Would you read?
Fairy spirit can net from the state. What's the back rider of the red wind as harassed intelligence lift down long man from the bad mystic plan that begins the world and reaches that at which at the beginning can span the burning vision of desire without themselves. It was took numberless men, a made of multitude and uncertainty, which it called and to pursue the world. From countless worlds, it was the worst of time, so surface unending difference, it burns all rest with an endless fire, radiance gleaming on murky skin, it climbed towards heaven, then sank, engulfed towards hell. It climbed to drag down, put into the mire, and used for muddy lands its brilliant force, and whose channel and gold and blue and red, turned into bark and gray, and went down, like youth grown, hungry and spared from the modern walk of life, the snap of insect joy, its favorite food, the deep sustenance of the
thank you. Fiery spirit, a hunchback rider of the red wild ass. Wild asses are notoriously uncontrollable. You know, better not try to ride them.
Is there a classical image of this? Like we have Shiva's image in the first one? This image is...
No, I don't think so. Sri Aurobindo's giving us his own. Why is it red? Because it is rajasic, it's the vital force. The other one, the previous one was inert, no, dark. This is red, violent red. And there he is always rushing about on his red wild ass. Sorry? Fiery spirit. Yes. So that great mystic flame, of course, it's Shiva's flame, isn't it? That great mystic flame that rings all the worlds. It's the flame of energy, great energy, but also of destruction. With its dire edge, with its sharp, painful edge, that flame eats at being's heart. So from that flame sprang the burning vision of desire. And that spirit takes 1,000 forms, numberless names. but its characteristic is a need of multitude and uncertainty. So it's always being goaded further to pursue the one, the oneness, on countless roads across the vasts of time, through circuits of unending difference, ever changeable. That spirit burns all breasts with an ambiguous fire. It's two-sided, that it has light, it has radiance, but that light is shining on a murky, muddy stream. It flames up towards heaven, but then it sinks down again. It's engulfed by that muddy stream, sinks down even to hell. It climbs up and wants to drag down truth into the mud where it lives, no? And it uses for muddy ends this brilliant, vivid force that it has. So Shobindo gives the image of a huge chameleon, always changing color, no? Gold and blue and red, turning to black and gray and lurid brown, a kind of fiery brown. So this mind, Shobindo images it like a chameleon staring from a mottled bough of life, a branch of life which has many colors. And what it's going to do, it's looking to snap up, you know, the way chameleons snap up with their tongues. Insect joys, its favorite food. Those insects that are ephemeral, no? They come, they look gorgeous, then they're gone, they don't last long. The dingy sustenance of a sumptuous frame. Maybe the insects are like dragonflies, they're beautiful colors, but the actual substance is dull and dingy. That's what he eats, that's what he consumes. That nurses the splendid passion of its many colors, of this chameleon.
The first mind, I think, is the physical mind.
Yes.
What is this?
This is the vital mind.
Previous one was a physical mind?
Yes. So, sorry?
You could compare comparisons with different parts of the brain.
Yes, we have these different parts of the brain. Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah, thank you. I can't hear you, dear.
The first one was the physical mind, and this is the vital.
Yes. So he continues this description of the vital mind. It goes another 1.5 pages. We have time to read it, I think. Lela.
A snake of flame with a dark cloud of a tail, followed by a green broom of beautiful thoughts, a lifted head with many hinged, glittering breasts, slick at knowledge with a smoky tongue, a wheelful sucking in an empty air, to bathe on vacancy stupendous flames, in nothingness, warm nothingness return, yet quickly it drove towards the hidden something that is old, ardent to find, incapable to retain. A brilliant instability was its mark, to earth its inward trend, its native clue. At once, to an unreflecting credence thrown, it thought all truth that flattered its own hopes. It cherished golden nothings born of wish. It snatched at the unreal for provender. In darkness, it discovered the luminous shapes. Peering into a shadow hung half light, it saw huge images told on fancy's cave, or it swept in circles through conjectures night and caught imagination's camera, bright scenes of promise held by transient flares, fixed in life's earth, the feet of hurrying wings, kept prints of passing forms and hooded powers, and flash images of half-seen verities.
Thank you. So many symbolic pictures evoked here. The first one is a bit like a dragon, a snake of flame with a dull cloud for tail, and it's followed by its children, a dream brood of glittering thoughts. And when it lifts its head, many-tinged flickering crests like flames, and it puts out its tongue, it licks at knowledge with a smoky tongue. But then there's this other next image about a whirlpool sucking in an empty air. It based on vacancy, on nothingness, stupendous claims. It's born out of nothingness and it goes back to nothingness. And yet Sri Aurobindo says all the time, unconsciously, unwittingly, unknowingly, it is moving towards the hidden something, the mystery that is all. Something about this, yes. I mean, if we think about the vital mind, its enthusiasm maybe comes from nothing or next to nothing. No? And it burns for a while and seems to be very full of energy and promise, and then there's nothing there at all. It's just like a whirlpool sucking in empty air, and nothing comes of it. There are far too many examples in everyday life in Auroville, but let me not go into that. But he says it's not worthless, no? After all, without knowing, it is driving at that something which is everything. But its other characteristics, it's very enthusiastic to find new things, but it can't hold on to them. A brilliant instability is its mass. Nothing firm and reliable there. Just the opposite of the previous one. To err, to make mistakes, is its inborn trend, its native cue. Can be sure that it's going to go wrong somewhere. And then this, at once, it jumps immediately and believes in things. It's prone to an unreflecting credence. It says, yes, yes, of course, that's the thing. It thinks everything's true that flatters its own hopes. And it cherished golden nothings born of wish, wishful thinking.
You can have wishful thinking, but then if you're smart enough to offer to the divine and collaborate, then the wishful thinking comes true.
It may come true, yes, yes. In fact, he's going to tell us that this thing that we have to be very careful about, this mind, but it has possibilities, no? Important possibilities. Yeah. Great. So somebody's sanctioning your wishes. That's wonderful.
In the previous page where a snake of playing with the it relates to a dragon, that you say. No?
I mean, for me, it gives something of the picture of a dragon, yes.
But on 24th of November 1926, and the background, the dragon...
Mother had a wonderful embroidery of three dragons.
Yes.
I'm not saying anything against dragons. What? Yes. No, dragons are very interesting. Well, they're symbols of forces, aren't they? Yes. And there's that dragon force which hoards all the treasures of the world and sits on them and won't share them. That's one aspect of the dragon. But the other one is spreading and gift-giving. So I think these three dragons probably, I don't remember the order of the colors, but one of them was golden, no, of the three dragons in Mother's beautiful Chinese or Japanese embroidery.
In the Japanese temples, very, very often, you have fountains and so on. And water
comes out of the dragon's mouth.
There is a picture of that?
What?
There is a picture of that.
That
dragons.
Tapestry of Mother's? I've never seen it. It would be wonderful. Perhaps they are there, kept hidden away in the ashram somewhere.
But in Japan, they create water?
No, the water comes from the mouth.
They can create water. The water comes from the mountain, goes in the mouth of every dragon.
When there are fountains, the water comes out of the mouth of the dragon.
In Singapore, they have a huge.
It's a mixture of lion and dragon, I think. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah,
was some exhibition in ashram in the front of the ground. Inside, you have a lot of clothes and some souvenir of mother and child, you know, what was a deal. Yeah, in entrance inside is near the playground.
Yes, yes.
You have a lot of
things, yes.
You have the writer of child.
Yeah, but whether that cloth is there, I don't know. I would love to see it. So, shall we try and finish reading about this? Or at least we can just read.
I have a question.
Yes.
The physical mind and vital mind, and the next one, they are actually tyrants in our life. So, for the physical mind, bodily exercises like yoga, walking, they have to control that. What helps with the vital mind?
Mother was talking that we need to feed the vital. I don't know if it is the vital mind. She said that you need to feed the vital. If you don't feed the vital, it gets sulky. Yeah?
Yes.
That's what you said. If you don't feed it, it gets very sulky. So mother is referring that you need to have art, music, dance, drama, that kind of thing.
Yes.
To refine the vital.
To refine the vital, that's the thing. Yes.
You don't
kill it, because it is such an important factor in manifestation. And that's one of the characteristics that distinguishes Sri Aurobindo's view from the many traditional spiritual views, where we try to suppress the life instincts. No, we have to refine them and purify them and use them for the divine purpose. Yeah. So I think it would be nice just to read on to to line 406, the rest of this description of the vital mind. We can look at it again next week. In darkness, it discovered luminous shapes. Peering into a shadow-hung half-light, it saw hued images scrawled on fancy's cave. Or it swept in circles through conjecture's night and caught in imagination's camera bright scenes of promise held by transient flares. Fixed in life's air, the feet of hurrying dreams kept prints of passing forms and hooded powers and flash images of half-seen verities. An eager spring to seize and to possess, unguided by reason or the seeing soul, was its first natural motion and its last. It squandered life's force to achieve the impossible. It scorned the straight road and ran on wandering curves and left what it had won for untried things. It saw unrealized aims as instant fate and chose the precipice for its leap to heaven. Adventure its system in the gamble of life. It took fortuitous gains as safe results. Error discouraged not its confident view, ignorant of the deep law of being's ways, and failure could not slow its fiery clutch. One chance made true warranted all the rest. Attempt, not victory, was the charm of life. An uncertain winner of uncertain stakes. Instinct its dam and the life mind its sire. It ran its race and came in first or last. Yet were its works nor small and vain, nor null. It nursed a portion of infinity's strength and could create the high things its fancy will. Its passion caught what calm intelligence missed. Insight of impulse laid its leaping grasp on heaven's high thought had hidden in dazzling mist. Caught glimmers that revealed a lurking sun. It probed the void and found a treasure there. A half intuition purpled in its sense. It threw the lightning's fork and hit the unseen. It saw in the dark and vaguely blinked in the light. Ignorance was its field, the unknown its bride.
I have another question.
Yes.
Verse 251,
the archangel's gaze knows
inspired
his path,
yes,
and shaped the world in its far seen plane. So I did not really understand what is this archangel and his path and his path. Yes, we are back now about the mind power on page 245, line 251. So he's speaking about this power who is bringing thought power and knowledge into the world. And he says that this mind power, her sun is only half risen, she's working within limits, but she is in possession of her field. She has some true knowledge and power. In her eyes, although they maybe have dark fringes, they may seem like dark eyes, but they carry within them the gaze, power of vision, of the archangel, this great high divine power who knows his acts are inspired, and he, archangel, shapes a world by the power of his vision. Later on, when we come to the next canto, the kingdoms and godheads of the greater mind, we shall learn more about this seeing creative power. But even this power who is bringing mind force into our world through these lower instruments, she's carrying some of that light of vision with her. Mm-hmm. She has a privilege of thinking force. That is her characteristic. Lorraine?
Something, line 249, line 2.
Yes,
the charm of life. I've been beating myself and others for not succeeding in what I think I must succeed in.
So there's a part of us which loves to try new things, and doesn't matter much whether we succeed or not, just the attempt is great.
If at first you don't succeed, try.
Yeah, I think this vital mind is not very persevering. If it doesn't succeed at once, then it drops it, moves on to the next thing. So shall we stop there for today?
Thanks to Sherbindle.